Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Takeaway Weekender. I'm Technical Director Jay Cowett here with Senior Producer Irva Gunja. Hello, Irva.
Hey, Jay.
Irva, really the only thing that we could think to talk about on the Weekender this week was this.
This country doesn't torture. We're not going to torture. We will interrogate people we pick up off the battlefield to determine whether or not they've got information that'll be helpful to protect the country.
I do not agree with the use of the word torture.
The only defense against terrorism is offense.
We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows and in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong.
Most of us didn't know what waterboarding was when we began this.
Everybody needs to know what happened and why it happened.
It appeared we turned a blind eye in many cases.
We tortured some folks.
The president believes that on principle, it's important to release that report.
We practice torture and do things that diminish and even harm the image of the United States and motivate our enemies, then it could have profound consequences in the future.
We did some things that were contrary to our values.
This nation should never again engage in these tactics.
Wow, just an incredible evolution from where we were in 2001 to where we are today. As we all know, the Senate Intelligence Committee released their torture report earlier this week. Some really big revelations in there about just exactly the kind of practices America was participating in and condoning around the world when it comes to holding terrorist suspects, holding detainees. We've had lots of conversation here on The Takeaway about that.
Yeah, it's absolutely taken over a lot of our editorial discussions because the release of this, while we all knew it was coming, down the line, is a huge thing. I mean, us as news gatherers, this is something that's been 14 years in the making. It's been going on a long time. And I think there's differing views within the media about what this means. Is it important? Do the American people care about this? And I think that's still very arguable about whether they do. But for us, reading these reports and seeing these this evidence laid out in a delineated form really kind of puts in a perspective the kind of things this country was thinking about and doing in the years after 9/11.
Yeah, and it's really about access to information, too. I think that for a lot of people in the media, this is about whether or not the American people have a right to know. That was a conversation we had started here on The Takeaway. We had lots of you participate in that conversation. Do we just at the most fundamental level have a right to know this information? The Senate Intelligence Committee has been working on this for nearly 5 years now. There's been a lot of efforts by the CIA, by a lot of Republicans to stop this report from coming out, to postpone it for as long as possible, if possible, just to bury it altogether. Dianne Feinstein, who leads that committee, ended up being successful and it was able to get it out before the Congress changes leadership next year. But I think that really is a big question about how much information do we have a right to know when we consider ourselves in a war, when we want to put a lot of trust and faith in the CIA, in our government to do things in our best interest, when we know that things aren't going to always necessarily be ethical. Lots of fascinating, lots of really, really big, important questions about our democracy, about our values, about who we are as a nation.
And I think you bring up the great point. It's not just the notion of what we were doing in terms of enhanced interrogation or torture. It's about some of the things we were doing to potentially either cover that up or make it easier to continue doing so. For instance, and Matthew Keyes, a journalist out on the West Coast, had a great Twitter feed kind of dissecting the report. But if you really get into the report, there's stuff about talking about isolating and making incommunicado certain prisoners after they had been tortured or interrogated,
right,
so that they wouldn't talk about it after. And that kind of thing, maybe not as much as torture, but certainly goes against what we think about as American values as well, one would think. Someone we talked to this week, who of course is going to be one of the best voices on this, is Bob Baer.
Yeah, you've got Bob Baer. He's a former CIA operative based in the Middle East. He's author of the book, The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins, very critical about what the CIA was doing. We also spoke with retired Brigadier General David Irvine. David's a really interesting guy. He spent 18 years with the 6th U.S. Army Intelligence School. He's been teaching about prisoner of war interrogation and military law, also very critical. Take a listen to what they had to say.
Let me begin with you, General. What surprised you most here? What outraged you most? What do you think Americans should focus most closely on in this Senate report?
Well, I think the most shocking thing about that report is that it was describing acts and conduct by officers and agents of the United States of America. And secondly, that all of this was launched on the orders of the President and Vice President of the United States.
And even though they didn't know particularly the details, they basically created the culture that produced these abuses. Where did they get the actual torturers, based on your reading of the report? Any idea here, General?
This is one of the really curious aspects of the whole program. It was evidently promoted and sold to the CIA by two psychologists who had no experience as interrogators, who had never interrogated anyone, who had no experience with Middle Eastern culture or Muslim culture, who had no experience with law enforcement, and who evidently were completely uninformed about the history of interrogation in the United States as far as the FBI is concerned, as far as the Defense Department is concerned, who had no understanding of the prohibitions on torture that are a part of federal and international law. It is just astounding that these two men influenced an entire intelligence agency to abandon the practices that had been so successful for years and years and years.
And let's remind you who's speaking right there. That's retired Brigadier General David Irvine, 18 years with the 6th U.S. Army Intelligence School, teaching prisoner of war interrogation techniques and military law. Okay, so Bob Baer, it sounds like what the general is saying here and what the report outlines is that Bush and Cheney at some point basically put an ad in the paper saying wanted inexperienced psychologists to freak out bad people in the Middle East, willing to inflict pain, you know, please apply.
General Irvine is 100% right on this. And I wouldn't put the blame doorstep of the White House, but I would the Central Intelligence Agency, who at that point had no experienced interrogators. It's something it had never done over the years, or at least not since Vietnam. And they go out and they outsource it to Mitchell and Jessen, two people who have no experience in anything. They'd seen a couple SEER manuals. That's what the SEALs use to train their own people. But what they didn't know, the SEER training wasn't for interrogation. It was simply to demonstrate to SEALs what it's like to be waterboarded and what they could face if they were captured. And it wasn't a way to extract information from enemy prisoners. Not only that, and this is sort of an aside, but I just find it completely offensive that they turned this into a business. They made $81 million out of this for doing something they had no idea what they were doing. On top of it, the CIA people assigned to interrogations were the lower 10%. They had all sorts of issues. They shouldn't have been in the field. In Afghanistan, when a young officer murdered a detainee, died of hypothermia, he was left out in the cold, he was awarded a money award. And not only that, this isn't a story, it hasn't been reported, but the chief of station in Kabul, a man I know, was given the Near East Division as a promotion, you know, after this man was murdered. So there was absolutely no accountability. And on top of it, it's very clear to me they were lying both to the administration and to the press. There's a journalist that wrote a book about this, a guy named Kessler, saying how effective this was. And even a reporter at the New York Times was fed this stuff that we were getting great information. So it was an effort to mislead the American public and not just Congress and the White House. I just think this is awful. And I just don't see how we can let this go. It's as bad as Watergate.
Remind us of those names you used, these psychologists who allegedly made $81 million.
This is Jessen and Mitchell, retired military, but they had not been in interrogations. And they simply took SEER manuals from the Navy without really looking at them and applied those techniques to hostile interrogations, then almost killed a couple of these people, and did it repeatedly without letting people up the line know.
So how do both of you respond then to, all right, bad stuff, but there have been no attacks, and okay, maybe they were wrong about what led to killing Osama bin Laden, but, you know, I'd certainly rather have this situation than a bunch of, you know, bombed out Mall of Americas around the United States if we'd let up and been a good guy like we usually are here. That's some of the comments that have come out even from former CIA officials who are responding to this report. General?
Well, I think those who are still claiming that the CIA interrogation program saved lives and produced all of these successes, at this point, after the revelations in the Senate committee report, really are under an obligation to show us the money. They have never done that. And there have been all of these claims that, well, if you only knew what we know, you would understand that this was very effective, that thousands of lives were saved. That's not the conclusion the Senate committee reached after 5 years. And at this point, for anyone to claim that there's still something out there that hasn't been revealed, that if we only could share with them or share with you, you'd understand all of this, I think that's just a false argument.
Bob Baer, what's your assessment of that?
Let me put it nicely. They're lying. There was no evidence, none that anybody's seen. I'm absolutely sure it would have leaked out, that one of these interrogations saved lives and sort of like a 24 a ticking bomb scenario. It just hasn't happened. And if a prisoner comes up with a little bit of information, they are showcasing that and saying, look, it works. But in fact, there has never been a case. And Congress, as you know, can't keep its mouth shut. And somebody would have said something by now. So, you know, I don't buy it at all. I've seen this in my career in the CIA, reclaiming we know something, and it turns out to be less than meets the eye.
General, what do you know, if anything, about individuals who may have stood up and said, I'm not going to do this. I don't care what happens to my career. I'm not going to go down this road with these psychologists and whoever else they found to do some of these things that Bob Baer describes.
I can't speak for anyone who is associated with the CIA. I'm sure there are officers and men and women who serve the agency who have that kind of indignation and who took those kinds of positions, but I'm not aware of them. I will say that there are others who stood up to the proponents of these techniques and who were incensed and who did lay their careers on the line. And one of those was Alberto Moro, who was the general counsel for the Department of the Navy, who took on Secretary Rumsfeld and who fought that program with everything that he had. And anyone who might be opposed to that program was frozen out of the discussions and was denied an opportunity to remind those who were promoting it that they were heading down a path that was not only illegal and immoral, but was also without any record of effectiveness that would warrant its adoption.
Finally, to both of you, what do you make of the suggestion by some human rights organizations that, you know, admitting a mistake is not enough, that what the United States needs to do to be accountable to the world is basically initiate some sort of Nuremberg-like process, and that this needs to be adjudicated in an international criminal court of some kind, and that detainees like the Jose Padillas of the world need to be represented as a human rights crime, war crime tribunal, and that that's really the only way to achieve accountability here. Bob?
Well, I don't see how we can go out in the world now and in any way condemn other countries for doing the same thing we're doing. How can we avoid this? How can we go to Iran and say you have to stop torturing people? You know, internal political prisoners, what's the difference? That's going to be a difficult road to go down, and I doubt we are, but it's a legitimate demand.
General Irvine, are we in the Radovan Karadzic Club all of a sudden?
I think we're getting awfully close.
retired Brigadier General David Irvine spent 18 years with the 6th U.S. Army Intelligence School teaching prisoner of war interrogation techniques and military law. Robert Baer is a former CIA operative based in the Middle East, author of the book The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I mean, I've been thinking about this all week, Jay. Is this our Watergate?
So I think it's an interesting comparison because with Watergate, you had people who were involved being contrite after the fact. Nixon stood there and apologized. There was certain shame there. In the case of the Senate report, you have almost all of the CIA and all of the principals who were involved standing by their actions.
Absolutely, right.
All the way through. And they've done all this week, from Brennan to Hayden to Cheney. All of them have not come out and said, you know, we did this the wrong way. We maybe had a few bad months and then got it, you know. They
so
have
far
not
it's been complete
that.
Support.
They've had complete support of what they did and the results that they believe they obtained by these methods. So it's a fascinating dichotomy between the two. So, I mean, Watergate is a very dark period that everyone in the country was thinking about. I wonder whether the country as a whole will continue its anger or continue its ambivalence towards this whole report.
Well, Anthony D. Romero is the next person I want to play for us because he's the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. He had a really provocative thesis. He wrote this piece for the New York Times op-ed pages, and he wrote, listen, either we got to prosecute here or we got to pardon.
So who would you recommend pardoning and for what at this point?
Well, let's first start with the most important question. What do we do now with this report? Where do we go from here? And it seems to me that unless we take up this question of accountability for torture, we're really not doing the report its service. We need to either prosecute these individuals, and if the president doesn't show the willingness or the appetite to prosecute them, then he ought to formally pardon them. But this limbo we're in of this tacit pardon that crimes occurred but no one is a criminal is just simply untenable in the face of the Feinstein report, which is damning about the extent to which crimes were indeed committed by criminals who are still out and loose.
Well, let's take the case of CIA Director Michael Hayden as an example here, just as a hypothetical. Could the president pardon him for perjury? And in that case, could he appeal the pardon?
You know, part of the reason why I want to throw out this idea of these preemptive pardons is that, you know, once you pardon them, you've labeled them a criminal and you've pardoned them for the crimes. So what Hayden thinks after being pardoned doesn't really matter very much. He's been emblazoned with the scarlet letter C for criminal, for having lied to Congress, for having misled the intelligence committees, for having authorized the torture that happened under his watch. And whether he likes it or not, he's a criminal who's been pardoned. And that's part of the reason why we want to force this question. It is not tenable right now for the Obama administration to mumble this line saying that crimes occurred, torture happened, but oops, no one's responsible for that, and no one's held accountable for it. That's just not tenable. You don't allow crimes to happen and not hold the criminals accountable. So either you formally pardon them, or you prosecute them. That's the choice.
As a legal matter, though, if you just pardon Michael Hayden for perjury or for these tactics specifically, is the lack of due process, at least in theory there, does that come directly from the universal, the extraordinary powers that the president has to pardon?
Exactly.
There's almost no restriction on it.
There's almost no restriction on it. I mean, the president can pardon anyone he wishes. You can do the preemptive pardons. You could do the en masse pardons like Jimmy Carter did with the draft dodgers. Abraham Lincoln pardoned the Confederate soldiers who fought in the war. Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon, as we all know, for all crimes he may have committed in his office. The question here is, what do we do to hold these government officials accountable? And a report that talks about the fact that torture happened, that the CIA misled the Congress, that the public was misled, that the brutal nature, I mean, when you listen to the Feinstein report like I was doing before, and you hear her talk in pretty shrill tones about the gruesome and extensive nature of these torture programs, we have to ask ourselves a question. If we're a nation of laws, and if our nation is one that believes in rule of law, then what are we going to do about these crimes? you can't but just believe that they just happened and that was just a sad moment in American history. People broke the law. So what are we going to do about it? Either we prosecute them or we pardon them for those crimes.
Well,
and the president can't sit on the fence.
Let's take your Nixon example. If we are going to do something about it and set into the record that this can't be done and that to do it would be a crime going forward, we're going to have to do something more specific than what Ford did to Nixon, because some of the abuses of Nixon continued after that pardon. They're going to have to sit down and specifically say, not simply, you're pardoned, Mr. So-and-so, but you're pardoned for this, this, and this.
Oh, yeah. You'll have to lay it out. And I think part of it, look, there's no easy or perfect solution to this. But right now, it's just untenable. We have Tenet, we have Bush, we have Cheney saying these weren't crimes. We stand behind what happened, that the Senate Intelligence Committee has got it wrong. And that is an untenable situation. Because in 20 years, when you have the George Bush's grandson in office, who believes he can resurrect the enhanced interrogation techniques and torture an individual that's in their custody, unless you put a very clear end to this torture story, it will always come back like a vampire from the dead. Jump off, one side or the other. Prosecute or pardon.
Anthony Romero is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union on what might be a legal lesson and legacy of the U.S. reaction to the terror attacks of 2001. Anthony Romero, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate it.
So beyond the repercussions as a nation and what that means for our reputation around the world, there's another factor here, and that are the legal repercussions that come from these individual detainee cases. Obviously, you've had a lot of these guys at Gitmo. You've had a lot of the people around the world. And now they'll be looking at the legal ramifications of what the U.S. had done to him after 2001. And it's going to come into play here as well.
We spoke with KSM's lead defense counsel, David Nevin, about the report and about what he's asking for now from the federal government.
The report tells us a lot, but there's a lot more yet to know. And we intend to get about the business of finding it out just as soon as we can.
Do you have the power to see what's been redacted in the report in ways that normal U.S. citizens don't?
No, we don't. This is part of a continuing problem with military commissions at Guantanamo Bay, is that large swaths of information are kept secret from us, despite the fact that it's a capital prosecution. There is just a whole array of information that we don't get to see. And that includes the redacted material in this summary.
I remember during the Iran-Contra situation, the congressional hearings and the prosecutions conflicted in the sense that one or another tribunal was able to grant immunity to people that then complicated their ability to give testimony. Do you have that same kind of problem with this testimony in the Senate report?
We have the same problem to this extent. It's clear that this is a political case. And this is a case that, under ordinary circumstances, would have been resolved simply and straightforwardly years ago. But the complicating problem is that persons in the executive branch committed serious domestic and international and war crime felonies, which could and undoubtedly would result in imprisonment if they were prosecuted. And so the government has been intent on protecting them. And the result is that we have a whole array of distortions that have arisen in our case at Guantanamo Bay. And those include interference from the political branches.
David, let's play a little game here. And I hope this is within your dignity as an attorney. Dick Cheney spoke on Fox News last night. There's probably a zero chance that the former vice president will actually sit on the witness stand down at Guantanamo. But let's pretend that he's giving this testimony as he spoke last night on Fox News. And I want you to cross-examine him with the questions that you might actually come up with if he said this in one of your tribunals. Listen.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the mastermind of 9/11, who has killed 3,000 Americans, taken down the World Trade Center, hit the Pentagon, would have taken out the White House or the Capitol building. And what are we supposed to do? Kiss him on both cheeks and say, please, please, tell us what you know. Of course not. We did exactly what needed to be done in order to catch those who were guilty on 9/11 and to prevent a further attack. And we were successful on both parts.
Counselor David Nevin, do you have any questions for the witness?
Well, let me just say, short of asking him questions that he's not here to answer, that's nonsense. Everyone knows that the torture didn't reveal anything that was useful. And everyone knows who's been around this kind of process. Everyone knows that the way you get people to talk to you is not by torturing them, but rather by treating them with some degree of dignity. And certainly my questions for the vice president, and I don't concede that he will not be on the witness stand, but my questions for him would take him, for example, to the Convention Against Torture, which the United States signed and ratified in the United States Senate, which says that nations that are signatories don't torture ever for any reason. We don't do it. We violated the law. And if he's part of, and one of the things you can be sure I would ask him is, let me see if I have this right, Mr. Vice President, did you approve this torture? Just look right over here and answer the question, did you approve this torture? Because when he says yes, he's going to be admitting to having committed serious felonies. Now, I don't know what his answer to that would be, but he and I and everybody else who's around this process knows that's malarkey.
So how does this change your strategy for defending Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, if at all?
Now, it probably doesn't change it much at all. Let me just say that if you've read the report and it's what it says about the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know that there is some detail provided there that provides some insight into what exactly the waterboarding was like and some of the other techniques that were used on him. But the difference between admitting we waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and on the other describing it in fine detail is a very important distinction. And, you know, we're entitled in a capital case in presenting mitigation to the jury. And in this case, the intimate details of the number of times that he was waterboarded, the specific sequence of events, the distended belly and the water flowing out of the mouth and vomiting and all the rest, and many other details, I might say, are all relevant to the question of describing this torture. So this summary of a report is a useful beginning, but it's a long way from an endpoint in terms of us being able to prepare our case.
David Nevin is lead defense counsel for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He spoke with us from his home in Boise, Idaho. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Well, it's just the tip of the iceberg there. There's so much coverage to come, and you, of course, have been weighing in.
Jackie, and I'm calling from Kannapolis, North Carolina. After listening to the report on torture, all I can tell you is I feel shame. I have lived in the Middle East in my younger days, and I just think that we're putting ourselves on the same level as the people that we're fighting.
National security experts with far more experience than 90% of your listenership are making these decisions on behalf of the American people. I, for one, support everything they do.
Scott from Woodinville, Washington. I think the greatest damage done from 9/11 was what we did to ourselves and our values as a nation. This torture report is a perfect example of that.
Garrett from Georgetown, Indiana. And I believe that action should be taken against the Senate Intelligence Committee because they have now put every military and foreign service officer in danger by releasing this report. It is unwise, and it was completely irresponsible.
Jim Wise, Dallas, Texas. If the CIA is going to do what they have been accused of doing, they need to be told that they're going to go to jail if they do it. Simple as that. Put them in jail.
Yes, this is Frank Jewer from Sunnyvale, California. I would say George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, not only did they destabilize the Middle East, but they also personally authorized the torture.
Kevin, in the state of Minnesota, I think we should step up our torture program because if that's what it takes to extract information that'll be used to protect the greater good, that's what it takes.
My name is Kate. I'm calling from Providence. Two things. Are we asking the question of whether the Islamic fundamentalism we are so concerned with today has anything to do with our torturing? And secondly, those men were tortured in my name and your name. So if we could internalize it and own it, maybe we can stop it.
Paul from Philadelphia. Everyone who participated in the CIA program should be held accountable as a deterrent to others in the future. Just like the rationale for justice system if I stole a TV. Everyone is equal in the eyes of justice, right? And let's skip the grand jury this time.
Our caller's there calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can give us a call at any point on this. I'm sure we're going to be covering a whole lot more on this report as the months go by.
Thanks so much, Jay.
Thank you. Good time as always, Irva.
And we'll talk more on Monday.
See you then.
This has been the Takeaway Weekender podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.